The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Mary Robinson is no stranger to this audience. She caused a political earthquake in 1990 when she became the first female president of Ireland. Following one term as president, which she actually cut short to take on a role as UN commissioner, she became a voice for human rights globally. Now she's chair of the Elders, which is a group founded by Nelson Mandela, who work for peace, climate justice and human rights. She's the subject of a documentary which is called, I suppose nicely, Mrs. Robinson. I've seen it and it will be on the big screen in cinemas from August the 24th. It's directed by Aoife Kelleher, and I went recently to talk to the pair of them, and I started with the director Aoife Kelleher and I asked her how the documentary came about.
So I was actually approached by the producer, Cormac Hargadon from Loose Horse, who had the idea that we as a team would pitch a documentary to Mary Robinson. And for me, it really felt like a no-brainer in that, you know, the moment of that presidential election in 1990 felt, you know, at the time and looking back, so extraordinary. It felt like a moment where so much became possible for, you know, I was an 8-year-old girl at the time, you know, for girls like me, for diverse communities around the country, for, you know, for minorities, for members of the LGBTQ community. And the idea of, you know, revisiting that moment and everything that led up to it and everything that came after was really appealing.
So Mary, when they came to you and said, we want to do a documentary on your life, what did you say?
I wasn't keen at all at the beginning, but Bride Rosny, who was my very dear friend, and the film is now dedicated to her, she was very keen. She said, you've had a long, full life. It will inspire quite a few people, especially women, and you must do it. And so,
now, it's a wonderful documentary, and it struck me that you have spent your life always doing the right thing, not the easy thing, and you've spent your life fighting.
Yes, I've had a good life in that sense, but I've also made mistakes, and I'm very glad that Aoife made sure that the mistakes came out as well, the warts and all, especially leaving the presidency early, which was a mistake, and then being led astray by a friend about Princess Latifah.
Yeah, and these are both featured in the documentary.
Yes.
Aoife, were you reluctant to bring out these controversial elements?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think first of all, there was a consistent willingness on Mary's part to really reflect on every aspect of her life and career. And I think it's really important to show that, you know, that leaders, that, you know, that the politicians, that there is that, you know, that people are fallible, you know, and that you don't have to be perfect to be a leader, but, you know, you have to have that capacity for reflection that I think comes across in the film.
From your very beginnings, you were aware of the inequality in life. You had four brothers, you were in the middle of them. And in this documentary, it shows you competed with them, whether it was playing football on the Strand or swimming or horse riding. It was competition all the way. And in spite of that sense of equality within the family, you thought there was a greater injustice at large.
Yes, because my parents kept saying to me that I had the same opportunities as my four brothers. Remember that, Mary. You have the same opportunities. But Irish society wasn't saying that. I mean, even during my childhood, I mean, my brothers were altar boys. I had to wear a scarf in church. I mean, everything was different. And I knew that women couldn't continue to work in the civil service if they married and so on. And so I had this strong inner sense of justice that, you know, things needed to be changed.
Now, the image that you have as a senior diplomat, you're the chair of the Elders at the moment, and you've occupied all of these great ranks in your life. And yet I find myself mildly shocked when you admit that Nick kissed you after you'd won a debating challenge. It kind of sent a frisson through me.
Through me at the time, too.
But all of these personal moments you've chosen to be revealed to us.
Well, first of all, Aoife's a pretty good questioner. She has done her homework. I had written about some of this in my memoir called Everybody Matters, which I think was published in about 2012. So a lot of it was semi in the public domain anyway.
Yeah. I mentioned your life of fighting and your early battles in the law, the fight for contraception, the notion that Ireland was a theocracy. And you had come back from Harvard looking at the great liberalism of the United States at that time and coming back to Ireland. And now, alas, it seems to be reversing.
I was very glad that Aoife, you know, wanted me to talk about that. And I didn't realise at the time, and I almost wondered why she was asking me so much about the United States. But it's really true that, you know, progress made by a country isn't necessarily secure. You've got to keep being vigilant and working at it. And we have seen in the United States, unfortunately, in a significant number of states and through the Supreme Court, that women's rights are going backwards. And it's really serious.
Interesting for people of a certain age to look back at a time when homosexuality was illegal. And how we have changed and how repressive forces are still at large in the world.
Yes, and again, I think it's good for young people to realise the progress that Ireland has made. I think this is something that Aoife felt strongly about when she was making the film, that you know, the changes have taken place quite rapidly and we've become a different country in many ways, and we see ourselves differently, more open, more inclusive. And yet we also have problems, particularly, for example, the current racism against migrants, which we need to really address and talk about a lot, and talk about what is a migrant. A migrant is the brave person who leaves their country to try and make a better living abroad, partly because of conflict, maybe because of sexual orientation, poverty, whatever it is. And they send money home. You know, they send the remittances back home. We should welcome brave people who come to our country and remember our own history, remember the famine, remember, and that's why the light in the window is so important as a symbol that created this sense of a diaspora which wasn't there before.
One of the most moving parts of the film, Aoife, is when you, Mary, visits Somalia, and to be reminded of the famine, the hunger, the child you might hold in your arms who might be dead within hours or certainly days. It was important maybe to remember that aspect of Mary's presidency.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that what comes across, particularly in relation to Mary's leadership, is, you know, that ability, I suppose, to kind of harness emotion and, you know, to acknowledge the ways in which she had been affected by her experiences in Somalia. You know, that moment where she was asked to turn to a camera while holding a starving infant, and how that changed her, you know, her relationship with, you know, the press, for example, that she was going to do what she was going to do and they could capture it, but she wouldn't perform.
You found yourself feeling guilty about mugging for the camera with the perhaps dying child in your arms.
Yeah. And also when I spoke to the press at the end in Kenya about in Nairobi about, you know, what I'd seen in Somalia, I wanted, you know, to make it so clear and forceful, etc. And I found my voice breaking and tears in my eyes. And I was furious with myself because I was a lawyer and I should be able to speak without emotion. But then afterwards, I realized it was far more compelling.
Now, the places you found yourself in Rwanda, for example, and then you have to, years after the massacre, the slaughter, the genocide in Rwanda, you find yourself shaking the hand of Paul Kagame.
Yes.
Bizarre.
Yeah, because, you know, like many other leaders of countries, you know, he's done good things, especially in the modern Rwanda. It has developed its education, health, its economy quite remarkably, but alas, part of it is raping its neighbour next door, the Democratic Republic of Congo. He supports a militia there called the M23. You know, people used to ask me when I was High Commissioner, what's the worst country in the world? And I would never answer that question. I would say every country has to be seen in its context. You have to see the good and the bad and speak out about the bad, but also value the good. And that's what I did in China, for example. I was by far the most outspoken voice on human rights in China, but I also gave them credit for taking so much of their population out of poverty, which means education, health, you know, rights to education and health, they're part of human rights.
One of the questions you were asked, and Aoife found this footage from the BBC, Jeremy Paxman asking you at the end of your tenure in the UN, were you forced out on foot of the criticism of what the Americans were doing in Guantanamo Bay?
Yes, I had agreed to serve one further year from my 4 years. This was before 9/11. as it happened, my extra year started on 9/11 by curious coincidence, and I was in Inchkey at the time having a bit of a rest. But anyway, during that year, I had to criticise the United States. I did say to Kofi Annan, when things got very bad, that I would be willing to stay on, because you don't leave a post when things are very serious, and the United States would not support. So
that was the end of that.
That was the end of that.
So again, being outspoken about all of these things, and you talk about climate. When did the impact of climate change dawn on you? Because you travelled the world as both president and as commissioner.
Well, I'm always very honest about how late I came to understanding the climate crisis. I didn't make any speech about climate when I was president. I did about the environment, but not climate. It just wasn't impacting Ireland. And then when I became High Commissioner, I realised it was serious, but another part of the UN was dealing with it. And I didn't relate it to my portfolio of human rights and gender equality and rights of Indigenous peoples. And, you know, it was afterwards when I had a small foundation working on a small NGO working in African countries, and I was honorary president of Oxfam, that my eyes were opened in 2003, 2004, 2005. Women in Africa would say to me, is God punishing us? We don't know what's happening. The rainy seasons aren't coming, or we have long periods of drought where we never should, and it's destroying our market, and we've no insurance, and we don't know what's happening. And then the injustice struck me, which is why I always talk about climate justice. The injustice that it affects the poorest countries much more disproportionately, and they're not responsible. That it affects women because of their different roles. That there's an intergenerational injustice. And look at what we're doing to nature, the injustice to nature of destruction of species, loss of the terrible destruction we're doing.
You talk about it being a man-made problem, with the emphasis on the gender man, but it might require a feminine response to fix it.
A feminist solution.
Yeah.
And I always explain that a feminist solution includes as many men as possible, because the feminist solution is the way women solve problems. They do it with less hierarchy, working together collectively, listening. Everybody has a say and a voice, and they listen to how it may affect different people and come to practical, step-by-step solving problems, problem solving. I regard that as the feminist approach. Obama described himself as a feminist. The current Prime Minister of Canada, Trudeau, says he's a feminist. I think we need to have more feminist men and boys to help us with the solution.
You insist that we have to follow the science, but you say the solution to this is within the heart.
Yes, because, you know, people are not so persuaded by statistics and by fear-mongering. It kind of switches them off. They just put the head down. But if you talk from the heart, and if you persuade people that it's in our gift to come to this much safer, healthier, renewable energy world with recycling and less waste, etc., and that it can have a dramatic effect on developing countries in particular, because they'll get access to electricity. I mean, you know, the stark reality of Africa, for example, where 900 million women still cook on dirty cooking, on, you know, coal, charcoal, animal dung, and they ingest, and many die. Millions of women die in Africa, and sometimes the babies on their back die with them because they ingest the smoke and the particles. And so many don't have access to electricity. I even remember my father talking to me about rural electrification when I was a child growing up in Mayo, and the difference it made to him as a doctor, seeing women out of what he called drudgery. And yet 900 million women in Africa have drudgery every day of going out for that firewood, going out for the water, going out because they don't have electricity.
Does it ever feel hopeless to you?
No, because I learned a great lesson from Archbishop Tutu. He was chair of the elders at the time. I was an elder. We were at a conference in America, in New York, on a social good conference. And it was full of young people. And when Archbishop Tutu is in front of young people, he waves his arms and he tells them how much he loves them and believes in them. And he was doing this. And the journalist who was moderating us said, Archbishop Tutu, why are you such an optimist? And he looked at her and he said, oh, no, I'm not an optimist. I'm a prisoner of hope. And that was a very impactful phrase for me, prisoner of hope, because I saw what he meant. You know, he had chaired his Commission on Truth and Reconciliation when they got over the apartheid regime. Hope means that you, you know, you see what can be done and you take whatever steps you can to do it. Whereas if you take the climate and nature crisis, you can describe it in terms that make it so appalling that everybody just puts their head down and says, well, look, I can't do anything. Whereas if you say we're on the cusp of a clean energy, safer, better world, we can move faster, but we have to move together.
And then along comes Donald Trump.
Well, that's the problem. But, along comes Kamala Harris.
Finally, Aoife, trying to compress 80 years of an incredible life into an hour and a half.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it's, you know, it's an extraordinary wealth of, you know, of archive, of home movie footage, of, you know, of interviews. I mean, over 12 hours of interviews with Mary alone. You know, all of these pivotal events throughout Irish society, you know, from the issues that she took on as a lawyer and a senator to the presidential campaign and beyond. But then on the other hand, you know, there's this sense that you can't include everything. You know, I mean, I think even the presidential campaign alone, we could have devoted an entire feature film to that. So there's a huge amount of angst always about the cuts that you make and what you leave out. And, you know, I would have spent, you know, endless time on the, you know, the women's movement, for example. But you do your best and you hope that it worked.
Are you happy, Mary?
I was very happy with the film at the end, yes. And I'm glad it's dedicated to Bride.
Mary Robinson and Aoife Keller, thank you both very much for joining us on the programme.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.